Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Coming up this hour, should Native American names and images be used for schools or teams? The debate is intensifying with the growing social justice movement. Also, the future of Penn's Landing is beginning to take shape. The Philadelphia Inquirer's Inga Safran will tell us about a New York developer's plan to transform this sought-after site. But to begin, Delaware holds its state primary election tomorrow, and there are some contentious races on the ballot. Progressive candidate Jessica Scarane is hoping to unseat junior U.S. Senator Chris Coons in the Democratic primary. Democratic Governor John Carney is seeking re-election as well, with one Democratic challenger and about a half dozen Republicans in the GOP primary vying for a chance at the governor's seat. Also, the Wilmington mayor's race will likely be all but decided tomorrow. Two Democrats are challenging incumbent Mike Perzycki, who is finishing up his first term, and there are no Republicans on the ballot. And how's the vote-by-mail process going? Lots to talk about. Joining us now is Mark Eichmann, Deputy Managing Editor of WHYY's Delaware Desk. Always good to have you with us, Mark.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So let's tackle the Senate race first. Senator Chris Coons is a Democrat who's widely seen as a moderate, willing to reach across the aisle, even in these contentious times. And Jessica Scarane is taking him to task on some of this. Tell us more.
Yeah, she's coming at him from a progressive standpoint. It's something we've seen Delaware senators 2 years ago, Senator Tom Carper, challenged in the same way by kind of an upstart progressive campaign. So this is Scarane's first campaign as a candidate. She's worked at, you know, advocated for other candidates before, but this is her first time on the ballot. And this year really was not exactly the campaign she was hoping to run with the coronavirus. And, you know, she had planned to get out and knock on, you know, as many doors as she could. And that didn't really happen over the last, you know, 6 months. So she's called, she's used the phone. They've called some 600,000 people, which is more than half the state's population. So they've really been trying to, you know, beat the bushes and try to get in contact with as many people as they can, which is, you know, kind of needed against an established threat like Chris Coons, who's been in the Senate for 10 years. Mm-hmm. Newcastle County government, the state's most populous county, for 10 years before that. So she's coming at Coons from the left side of the Democratic Party. She supports things like the Green New Deal, Medicare for All. And as you say, Coons is a more moderate Democrat who prides himself and gets criticism from folks like Scarane for his ability to work across the aisle, or his willingness even to work across the aisle. He says it's better to focus on proposals that have a chance of getting bipartisan support rather than advocating for things that are never going to get approved in the, you know, the kind of vitriolic Senate that exists right now. So as Scarane points to that willingness on Coons' part, you know, to him being too chummy with Republicans, and that's really where she's been kind of banging the drum against Coons and trying to drum up support for herself.
So, Mark, you were trying to get a debate set up between Coons and Scarane. Wasn't going to happen. Coons was not willing to debate. Thoughts as to why, and is he seen as vulnerable here?
Yeah, there's a reason why. The reason we were given was that he ran out of time. He didn't have enough time with activity in Wilmington for the Democratic National Convention late in August. We had reached out to the campaign, both campaigns, early to mid July to try to set something up for the end of August. And the Scarane campaign obviously immediately on board any chance they could get to get their message out.
Sure.
Coons' campaign was very slow to reply, and eventually got back to us late August and said he didn't have time. Whether he's vulnerable or not, I wouldn't use that word. I think very entrenched in the incumbent, as an incumbent Democrat throughout history in Delaware, they've been very successful. So we'll have to wait and see. But I would not think he's vulnerable. It would be a big upset if Scarane was able to.
Okay. One more question regarding the Coons-Scarane race, and then we'll get on to the governor's race. Chris Coons is close to Joe Biden. So if Coons does win the primary tomorrow, retains his seat after the general election, and if Mr. Biden wins the presidential race, Does Chris Coons land a role with the administration? Is that seen as likely?
I asked him that, and Scarane is definitely putting that out there, that to give Delaware voters the chance to choose their representative. He said that those are both big ifs. If he wins and if Biden wins, he said he wouldn't commit to running a full 6 years or serving a full 6 years. He said he would do whatever is best for Delaware and for the Biden administration if Joe Biden wins. So he said if he was offered a very senior position in the administration, he would strongly consider taking that. So something for voters to keep in mind.
All right, we'll see. Okay, another moderate, Delaware Governor John Carney, is asking voters to reelect him to a second term. He's got one opponent in the Democratic primary, 54-year-old David Lamar Williams. What do we know of Williams?
Very little. We from him, he's an accountant by trade. His platform includes a 4-day work week across the state and legalizing recreational marijuana, which is I'm not sure how Carney feels about the 4-day work week, but he has been against legalizing recreational marijuana, even though there's been several attempts through the General Assembly to get that done. Again, with the pandemic and its impact on campaigning, we haven't really seen David Lamar Williams out and about. We haven't really seen Carney campaigning very much either. He's been very preoccupied, obviously, with the response to coronavirus. Yeah. And, it's just another one of those signs of this odd election year that there hasn't been a whole lot of, there hasn't been the meet and greets. There hasn't been even the parades or, the events that candidates would usually get out and you would be able to see and get to know a candidate. Voters really haven't had that chance this year. So David Lamar Williams, kind of an unknown. I would expect Carney to easily win the primary tomorrow.
Now, on the Republican side, there are six candidates vying for the gubernatorial nomination. They are taking aim at Carney over his handling of the pandemic and the shutdown of businesses. Is Carney vulnerable on this issue?
Well, there's been several protests, especially earlier in the summer, against the governor's emergency orders that closed businesses. There's been a reopen Delaware group that's been out and really trying to fight against the emergency orders that they say harmed businesses and did real damage to the state's economy. Republicans in the General Assembly tried to challenge the law that limits Carney's ability to extend these states of emergency, which he's done regularly month to month. So there's been discussion of Carney's maybe vulnerability on that issue. I'm not sure that any of the Republicans can make enough of a name for themselves to counter Carney. It's funny, the Republicans have struggled in recent years in Delaware to post candidates for different races. Some even statewide offices have gone unopposed by the Republicans, and Democrats have just had a walkover. Yeah. But now they have six people wanting to run for governor. You think that could be a good sign. Alternatively, you wonder maybe those candidates could have spread themselves out a little bit more over other campaigns rather than fighting amongst themselves for one seat against the governor. So is Carney vulnerable on that issue? Maybe that's one spot the Republicans can make some hay on, whether that's enough to overcome, Carney's popularity and also the massive voter registration advantage for Democrats statewide is definitely another thing. And I would be surprised, but we'll see in November.
Okay, so to the mayor's race in Wilmington, two Democrats running against incumbent Mike Perzicchi in the primary tomorrow. No Republicans on the ballot, apparently, in the GOP primary. So Right. The race could well be decided tomorrow. Mark, tell us briefly who the contenders are. Tell us a little bit about them.
Yeah, this is the race I think will be the tightest race of the night tomorrow night. So it's kind of up in the air. Perzicchi only won by less than 300 votes 4 years ago. So it's really going to be a tight contest, I think. Velda Jones Potter, she's made a name for herself. She was a city treasurer, is a city treasurer, and she's been battling even frustrating the mayor while she's been city treasurer. It's almost like she's been running this campaign, even though she didn't only announced earlier this year. It's almost like she's been running this campaign against the mayor while she's been in the treasurer's office. They've really butted heads and ended up in court over really the role of the treasurer and what the treasurer is supposed to do. Perzicki's maintained the treasurer exists to execute the money priorities of the mayor's office, and Velda Jones Potter, as treasurer, has really pushed to put her own mark on how the city spends its money. And then there's a third challenger in the race. That's Justin Wright. He was the youngest member of Wilmington City Council in 2008. He was elected at the age of 24 to council, and he served two terms before running for council president in 2016 and losing. So it's a three-way race, and with not that many votes probably being cast in the primary, it could be a very close margin of victory for whoever ends up winning.
Okay, and worth noting, Mark, incumbent Congresswoman Lisa Blunt Rochester has no opponents in the primary, the Democratic primary tomorrow, but the Republican primary is contentious. And again, Delaware is a solidly blue state, so probably not much of a threat to Blunt Rochester here.
Yeah, and I think Lisa Blunt Rochester is immensely popular among Democrats. As the state's first woman to be elected to Congress, the first Black woman to be elected to Congress as well. I think she's in a solid position. You know, the state has Democrats have about 48% of the state's voter registration compared to Republicans, just 27%. So it's a really big uphill battle for any Republican statewide to overcome, especially against a popular congresswoman like Lisa Blunt Rochester.
Okay, we've got about a minute left. So casting your ballot, if you live in Delaware and do not want to go to the polls, but you do want to vote, there is vote by mail. But at this late date, I mean, the primary's tomorrow, it's a little complicated. Mark, the state has sent applications for mail-in ballots out to registered Democrats and Republicans. If a constituent hasn't gotten that application in, is it conceivable they can visit their county office today to hand the application in, receive a ballot, and then drop the ballot off? It's a lot, but if they don't want to stand in line at the polls, is that something that's a possibility?
I believe that's a possibility. The state's website has the nuts and bolts at elections.delaware.gov, but ballots can be dropped off, you know, today, tomorrow at the county election office, and there's three throughout the state. It would be tight, but it's possible. It's doable.
And jumping ahead to the general election, if you want to vote for mail, I guess just look for the applications for ballots for the November 3rd election and then, get them in as soon as possible.
Right. They'll be mailed out to all registered voters, or should be mailed out to all registered voters. But if you don't get your application, you can request one online. Again, that's at elections.delaware.gov. And then fill it out and get your application back in.
Okay, Mark Eichmann, thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
Mark Eichmann is Deputy Managing Editor of WHYY's Delaware Desk. Stay with us. There's more of the Regional Roundup just ahead. Welcome back to
supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
A regional roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. For the first time in its history, the Washington football team has begun a football season without an official name. The old name retired after 87 years following outrage over its racist origin and imagery. However, in less than a month, the Neshaminy High School football team, bearing the same name, the Redskins, will open its football season. And across the state of Pennsylvania and New Jersey, dozens of schools use Native American imagery for team names and mascots. Words and phrases like Indians, Red Raiders, Shawnee, Cherokee, Golden Eagles, and Chiefs, a practice which many of Native American ancestry find to be unsettling and even offensive. Despite the burgeoning social justice movement, efforts to get schools to drop such imagery have been slow going. So this is what we're going to be talking about for the next 20 minutes. If you'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499, or send us an email to radiotimes@whyy.org. Donna Fan Boyle is of Cherokee Choctaw descent and a mom and co-founder of the advocacy group Coalition of Natives and Allies. Welcome to the Regional Roundup, Donna.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
So I don't know if you're a football fan, but the Washington football name controversy was ongoing for years. Let's start there. What was your reaction when you heard that the football team, the professional football team, had finally dropped its name?
Well, of course, I was thrilled, but, you know, apprehensive, because we've been working on that for numerous years. And, you know, with peaceful protests and just advocacy work. And, you know, we were saddened by the fact that it took the death, you know, that we had to witness the death of George Floyd for this movement, for people to finally pay attention, and for Dan Snyder to, you know, have his feet held to the fire and to show that he, you know, would do something, take a stance against racism.
There are apparently at least 60 schools in Pennsylvania alone which use Native American imagery, including the Neshaminy football team. So much of this, Donna, is deeply embedded into our culture. What is your response to those who might say naming a school after the Shawnee or Cherokee tribes, or using the word Indians or Chiefs for team names is honoring Native Americans?
Well, you know, a lot of those names were taken decades ago, you know, 90 years ago, you know, or during a time when Native people didn't have a voice. It was basically a crime to be Native, and you could be put in jail for practicing your cultural ways. Native children were taken away from their families to be taught to be non-Native, to be assimilated into culture. So during the time that those names were taken, you know, Natives were shamed for being Native. So how could, you know, non-Native people take a name and say that it's honor when it wasn't honorable or respectful or even acceptable to be Native during that time? And when Native people say that it's hurtful, that using our images and our names is hurtful because it provokes bad behaviors towards us, you know, dressing up in face paint and headdress and, you know, acting like a buffoon, that's harmful. So it's not just that it's offensive to us, it's actually harmful, and we don't want our children harmed.
So in your opinion, Donna, should all Native American imagery used for schools or professional teams be dropped? Is there ever a time when it might be appropriate to use Native American imagery? And I ask this because, say, the Atlanta Braves baseball team says it won't drop the Braves' name. They say it is honorific, but it is reconsidering the tomahawk chop, which is, you know, sports fans, you know, it's it's the motion and vocalization that fans make when they're revving up support for the team.
Right. Well, that chop is a murderous action, because the tomahawk chop was, you know, used for, you know, killing. And so how can that be an honorable action? But also, you know, these schools and, you know, the teams, they can't tell us that it's honor. You know, if we say that it hurts, then it hurts, and it's not just about offense.
We've got a call from Gary now, and he'd like to join the regional roundup with a comment. Welcome, Gary.
You know, killing, and so how can that be an honorable action?
But I'm not hearing him. Do we have Gary on the line? I'm hearing something, but I'm not sure it's our caller. Okay, we're going to just kind of...
Gary's on the line.
Oh, Gary is on the line. Okay. Hi, Gary.
Yeah, I was hoping to be able to hear the radio through my phone.
Oh, that's what I was hearing. Okay. Well, no, I mean, we were just... If you could just ask your question of Donna, that would be terrific. Thank you so much. Are you with us?
I am with you.
Okay. So, again, if you could just ask your question or give your comment, that would be great.
Okay. My name is Gary. I am a member of a golf club that's going to have a board meeting tonight to discuss whether we should retain our logo that has the image of an Indian with both arrows and golf clubs in quivers. I was always told that this was a sign of respect, honor, admiration for the Native Americans from 1901, and that I think the ultimate insult to the Native Americans would be to forget them by removing the image.
Okay, so yes, jump right in, Donna.
Yeah, so if you do away with your imagery or masketry, you know, you or any of these schools, we're still here. We won't disappear. The problem is that people think that that imagery represents us, and they don't recognize that we live next door to them, we work with them, that we look like everyday citizens. They don't recognize that we are Native Americans and this is what we look like. So that imagery is a false identity, a false perception. I mean, you don't know how many times I've had people say, oh, I didn't know that Native people still existed. All they think is that we look like people with feathers in our hair, wearing buckskins, you know, headdresses, and that we live in teepees. So you're doing away with our image will not make us disappear. In fact, our voice has grown louder recently because we finally have the power behind us because of George Floyd and the movement. We now have the power behind us to have a louder voice, and people are noticing that we are not going to be silent about this.
All right. Gary, thanks for reaching out to us here at the Regional Roundup. I'd like to circle back for a moment to discuss the movement to get Neshaminy High School to drop its football team name. As WHYY's Aaron Moselle reported last year, the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission has ruled that the district can continue calling some of its sports teams the Redskins, but must dump any logos and imagery that negatively stereotype Native Americans. So let's bring Tamika Hatcher into the conversation. She is Educational Outreach Coordinator with the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission. Welcome, Tamika.
Good morning.
I know we can't speak about the specifics of the Neshaminy case, but there has been such enormous social change since the ruling was made in November of 2019. Are you seeing an increase in complaints about Native American imagery at the commission?
No, we have not. We have not seen a large volume of cases in with that particular subject in the background. However, what we are seeing is increased cases in schools of bullying and targeting based on ethnicity.
Is the commission, Tamika, willing to revisit past decisions on Native American imagery in schools, considering the transformative moment we find ourselves in?
Well, I can't say specifically, but what I will say is that contingent upon what is happening as a result of actions that have taken place, there could be retaliation, and there's a very real possibility that we could revisit previous determinations or decisions based upon actions that are being taken against individuals as a result of an initial finding or a complaint.
So say in a specific school district there is bullying or retaliation because of a name that might remain in place. That might open up the process again. Is that what you're saying?
That could. That potentially could. But what I want to speak to specifically is that sometimes our intent does not equal the impact. And so while schools say that they will name their athletic teams after a Native American tribe as an honorific act, what they don't realize is that it has a negative cultural and social impact, not only on that particular group, but on society at large, because it then normalizes things like violence and the tomahawk chop and treatment of people that has been historically disparaging.
Is it difficult to affect change on the state level to even perhaps make a sweeping rule? I don't know if that has to go through the legislature, if it's something that the administration can somehow put into place to make a difference in terms of names, team mascots, et cetera.
Well, I would just say that from the very foundations of America and I'm trying to be delicate, but the only way that I can say it is just based upon the racist history of our country, it's not easy all the time to affect change, whether we're talking about at the local, state, or the federal level, simply because we have years and years of institutional and historical racism and bias. And that's what we are working to get at the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission. And while we may not always get it right, we do make our best effort and attempt to try to make persons whole when they file a complaint at the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission.
Let me ask the question another way. I mean, if, say, somebody in the Neshaminy School District, especially following the social change and the movements we've seen this summer, have decided, okay, we're finished with the name here, I really want to make change, and they file a complaint with the commission, what does the process look like, and how long might it take to effect change if that happens?
Well, if a person believes that they have a reasonable belief that they have been the victim of unlawful discrimination, they have a right to file a complaint. So if now or at any time, any student, faculty person, employee, working, attending in the Neshaminy School or any other school district or employer within the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania that we have jurisdiction over, they have a right to file a complaint. And the fact that we have made a ruling in this particular thing does not preclude them from doing that. Should actions or things have come up that is affecting a person, be it as an outlier to a complaint that has already come or actions that have happened since then, they can file a complaint. And the complaint process, depending, it could take some time. It might take anywhere from 6 months to a year. But in general, it takes about 60 days from filing for a case to be served.
Okay, Tamika Hatchett, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Tamika is Educational Outreach Coordinator with the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission. And we still have Donna Fan Boyle with us, co-founder of the Coalition of Natives and Allies. Donna, we've got another telephone call. Let's talk to Dan. He is in South Jersey. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Marty. I graduated Jersey High School back in the 80s. And I've always felt since then like, how was I able to get through 4 years of their curriculum? And I, to this day, couldn't really articulate anything to distinguish the Cherokee Nation from, say, Shawnee or Lenape or any other. And I think that's all the reason you need to say, you know, if you can't change, if you can't fit their heritage in your curriculum, then you need to take the name off the school and say, just call it Marlton High School or something.
All right, Dan, that's
my comment.
I was going to say, great comment. Thank you. And Donna, I was going to ask you this as well. Dan is talking about the curriculum at Cherokee High School in South Jersey. And, you know, as a mom, are you familiar with the curriculum in your area at Neshaminy? And does it address Native American history at all?
Well, I am familiar because my kids went through the school, you know, system. And it touches on it very little, but there is no real education about the people who were from this area that Neshaminy says that they are honoring with their racial slur. And so I think that they've had the opportunity for, you know, decades to educate about the people that they say that they're honoring. And no, there is no mention. I mean, there's not enough education about the Lenape tribes or the tribes who migrated through here who called it their homelands. So they've had plenty of time to do that, and they haven't done their job.
We've got an email from Aria who says, mascots aren't a way to remember Native Americans. Teaching the truth about our real history and who they are today is the way to honor and keep them alive in the culture. Donna, are you finding more allies in the community in, say, various school districts since the expansion of the social justice movement this summer?
Yes, there's a lot of people reaching out now. It's a huge movement. Our coalition has had numerous people reach out to us for support. We write letters of support and letters to school districts and administrators to let them know that we are there to educate, because we have an educational program, and we are there to support them through change and really help them through it, because it's very hard for administrators and school boards to go through this, because alumni want to hold tight to those, you know, it's their memories from the past, and they want to hold tight to that. But it seems like the young people If you let the young people speak and make a decision, it seems like they are ready for change. They understand the social injustices. And but, you know, the alumni want to get in there and, you know, teach them something else.
So you're seeing a difference from, I think, 7 years ago, because my understanding is you filed a complaint with the commission about the Neshaminy name, but you had to withdraw it 7 years ago in the face of community backlash. Are you seeing any change there?
Well, I mean, there's probably more people come out that agree that it should be changed. But I know when I go on certain Facebook pages that I was always a member of, because I'm a member of the community, and they have banned the topic from their Facebook page. For a while, the topic was there, and the backlash was horrible. The things that people would say to me and to other Native people, and even to the point where the administrators banned the Native people from that page because they said that we were stirring up controversy. Instead of banning the people who were really saying hateful things to us, they banned us and they banned the topic. So in that respect, it hasn't changed.
Do you have hope that life for your children as people of Native American heritage will be different?
Absolutely, because, you know, we've decided that enough is enough. We're not going to be silenced, and we're finding every avenue that we can to try to make change happen. I mean, from filing complaints to legislation, and the coalition has just seen a great influx of people who want change to happen. And there's so many more organizations now that are opening up to work on this. Young people have created organizations and Facebook pages, and it's really it's happening. The movement is happening.
Donna Fanboyle, it was so nice to have you with us. Thank
Can
you
I just
for joining
say one
us.
Thing?
Yeah.
I would also like to recognize that the National Congress of American Indians has been working on this for decades, and the American Indian Movement, which I am a member of the Ames Central Texas chapter, they have been working on this for decades too.
All right. Thanks for that. Great to have you with us. Donna Fanboyle is of Cherokee Choctaw descent and co-founder of the advocacy group Coalition of Natives and Allies. Appreciate you joining us here on the Regional Roundup. Coming up next, Inga Safran, architecture critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer, on the future of Penn's Landing. Stay tuned. This is
supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. It's taken decades, but a vision is finally in place for Penn's Landing. The City of Philadelphia and the Delaware River Waterfront Corporation have awarded the right to develop this coveted piece of real estate along the river to a New York developer, the Durst Organization. Durst beat three other applicants, including the Philadelphia 76ers, which had envisioned a new arena at the site. The Philadelphia Inquirer's Inga Safran calls all four proposals well done, but says the Durst plan stands out. So for the remainder of the show, we'll talk about why and what this proposal will bring to the city's waterfront. Inga Safran is architecture critic for the Inquirer and author of the new book, Becoming Philadelphia, How an Old American City Made Itself New Again. And Inga, it's good to have you with us again. Welcome.
Hi, Mary. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with the Durst vision. Everything, Inga, is still in the initial stages, but what will we likely see if final approval is given, construction's finished, and all has gone according to plan?
Well,
that's a big question.
If it goes according to plan, which things really do rarely do go according to plan, the Durst proposal calls for 12 towers. There are two sites that were auctioned. One at the very northern end of Penn's Landing near Market Street would have six rather tall towers. The tallest would be over 700 feet, which is about the height of the FMC Tower on the Schuylkill River. Mm-hmm. And then there'd be five other towers. They'd be mostly residential. This very tall one might have a little hotel component. There would be streets and pedestrian walkways at the base. There's a nice overlook. There would be perhaps a supermarket, a preschool, some restaurants. And then on the southernmost site, which is facing the marina and just south of this little green area we call Spruce Harbor Park, that would have shorter towers, not that short. They might be 200, 250 feet, and there would be six more there. And, you know, same deal. They would be residential. They might have some restaurants on the ground floor, but it would be pretty low key. There are no snazzy attractions. There's no arenas. There's no big theaters. It's just a residential neighborhood.
But it seems like a lot of density packed into a small space. Is that your perception as well? And is that a concern if it is?
It's a lot of density, but it's not too much density. You know, the question is, will there be demand for all that density? And, you know, given the moment we're in, it's, you know, who knows what might happen here.
So the coronavirus could change the picture and be a real factor in changing plans?
Sure, in the sense that there could be a big recession. Who knows what's going to happen with the economy? Developers tend to be very optimistic people, so they believe if we go into a down cycle, there will eventually be an up cycle after that, and there'll be demand for housing. This is not going to happen tomorrow. I mean, in best case, 3 or 4 years before a single thing happens.
Okay. Well, there was a whole lot of talk, of course, about the 76ers proposal to build an arena at Penn's Landing. Why do you think Durst won the day?
Well, let's start with the fact that they didn't ask for any tax subsidies, and the 76ers asked for an enormous tax subsidy. The 76ers, on their own initiative, added in a few additional sites to its proposal that were, not part of the what they call the RFP, the request for proposals. So, but people were kind of shocked by the size of that subsidy, and the two other losing applications also asked for various kinds of subsidies. So, it is remarkable that the Durst organization did not ask for any public money. So, I think that's one reason they won. I think another reason they won is because they hewed very, very close to the outline of the master plan. This is almost like, a building for building representation of the master plan.
The Waterfront Commission's Corporation's master plan?
Yeah, that's right. The buildings are a bit taller, perhaps, than envisioned, but it stayed pretty true to the master plan. And I think a third reason is that, unlike some apartment developers, this is a company that doesn't flip its buildings after they're built. It hangs on to them. And I think that offers more certainty. There's hope that the quality of the buildings will be better. The architecture will be better. It also, Durst also has a very strong record on sustainability. And because they would be the sole owner, they have this, they're proposing this very efficient heating and cooling plant that would serve the entire site. I think that was very attractive to the waterfront manager.
Mm-hmm. Let's just, one more question about the Sixers. Ever since I heard about that proposal, I thought, would an arena work in that space? It's such a big idea.
Yeah, I mean, I wondered, how it would fit. That the site where they were going to put it is about 7.5 acres. And, I did hear some architects wonder, was it going to be east-west? Was it going to be north-south? How would it be arrayed on that site? And the Sixers proposal also called for two high-rise buildings along with the arena on that northern site. So I wondered, how was it going to fit? How are they going to move people in and out?
Yeah.
Now, there was if you follow social media, there were a lot of people who say, oh, they have to build a big garage, et cetera, to get all the cars in there.
I think what the Sixers envisioned was a paradigm shift in the way people attend sports events. And they, you know, their idea was to have people come on transit. You know, there is a Market Frankfurt L stop at 2nd Street that's pretty easily walkable. Mm-hmm. It could have led to improvements in transit on Columbus Boulevard. We could have at long last seen this much talked about light rail. You know, there were a lot of uncertainties and a lot of ifs, and it would have been a big structure that, you know, would have really blocked off parts of the waterfront. So I think that was you know, not appealing.
The process of choosing a developer, you call this a true grown-up moment for Philadelphia. How so?
Well, no one was indicted. You know, Penn's Landing has this unbelievable history. You know, there have been more than six, you know, competitions like this in the past. Maybe eight. I forget the exact number. And two of them have ended up with you know, the city just like throwing out everything and people being indicted. So, you know. What made this one different is it was very deliberative. It was very, you know, they first they had a vision, you know, with a lot of public engagement that never happened before. That went on for, you know, more than a year, where there were these meetings where people came together and they had these, you know, sort of blue sky, like, what do we want for the waterfront? And that was led by Penn Praxis and Harris Steinberg and funded by the William Penn Foundation. And then after that, this new waterfront manager was created, and they did a master plan, was also involved a lot of public engagement. And so this process has been going on for 10 years, which is quite incredible, been very, you know, step by step. And I think, you know, that's why there's a lot of consensus around this choice and a lot of positive reaction to it, because people feel like they were listened to.
Okay. Well, Philadelphia seems to be evolving then. one question about, you know, you're saying that Durst did not ask for public subsidies. Does Durst receive the property tax abatement for this project?
Yes, they will. And that abatement, so now it's a 10-year abatement. Mm-hmm. And on the first of the year of the new year, it will effectively become a 5-year abatement.
What is your feeling, Inga, about the abatement these days? Has it done its job in spurring new construction in the city? Is it time at some point in the near future to sunset the abatement?
So, I'll say, when the abatement was first introduced in 1999, the city was in a very, very different place than it is now. And I talk about this in my book, actually. And, you know, we were just staving off bankruptcy. There was almost no new construction. And we were still losing population. We were losing jobs. And I think it was transformative. It was a very, very important policy. And it did its job. It did its job so well that I think when City Council reevaluated that policy a couple of years ago and changed it, that was the right thing to do. So, you know, did they rewrite it in exactly the right way? I think we could have more conversations about that. Like, for example, when they made it, it's effectively a 5-year abatement, although over 10 years, it's complicated. But, you know, there's no cap on sale price that you can receive the abatement for. So you know, you can buy a condo for $20 million and you can get that abated. The property tax is abated for 5 years. Like, should we have a cap? I think that's worth talking about.
I'm just going to, because I'm looking at the clock, and unfortunately, I'd like to get to another couple of quick questions here. Very quickly, back to Penn's Landing. What needs to happen now to solidify the Durst proposal?
So first, they got to make a contract between the Delaware River Waterfront Corporation, the agency that manages the waterfront, and Durst, you know, all the financial details have to be pinned down in writing. There have to be performance benchmarks and, you know, penalties if they fail to meet them. There has to be, you know, they have to work out who's going to manage which pieces of the waterfront. You know, is the waterfront corporation going to manage the esplanade? Is it going to manage the spaces in between the buildings? Is that going to be Durst? You know, zillions of little details like that. There'll be discussions about affordable housing. There'll be discussion. I believe Durst will need some zoning bonuses. You know, probably be some discussion about that. So but
Douglas,
you know,
Durst seems to be confident things will move forward. You mentioned confidence a little bit earlier in our conversation. He seems to be confident.
Yeah. No, I mean, as I said, developers are the most optimistic people in the world. And, you know, he said that his company was started by one of his forebears. It's been around for over a century. You know, they've lived through the Great Depression. They've lived through recessions. You know, developers believe the market will always come back. You know, that's why they bid on this. And they think this current difficult moment will eventually ease.
It'll be fun to watch to see what happens over the next, decade or so. All right.
Let's hope.
So let's switch gears for just a couple moments. Again, you've got a new book out, Becoming Philadelphia, How an Old American City Made Itself New Again, a collection of your work over the last two decades. Any stories, any essays stand out in your mind? And I'm thinking in terms of maybe side street stories, things that don't necessarily involve the big projects in, in Center City, say.
Yeah. So what stands out? When I first started, as I said, not much was being built in Philadelphia, but it does seem like in hindsight, kind of an inflection point. And so, you know, before we had this incredible building boom that we had right up until the pandemic, we convinced ourselves that in order to revive the city, we needed to build more parking. And this was during the Rendell administration and the street administration. And, you know, I really thought that was a very bad policy idea. And I ended up writing a lot of anti-parking columns, you know, don't build this garage, don't tear down this building and create a surface parking lot. It's self-destructive.
And it certainly isn't exciting.
It's not exciting. But, you know, I very early on, I was, you know, I was an advocate for, you know, a walkable, dense city. And I believe that that's what, you know, would ultimately cause people to want to live here and stay here. And, you know, to toot my own horn, I think I was right. And, you know, and we did get a lot of development and a lot of density. And over time, there was a change in the way people viewed the need for parking. Even the city changed its rules and began to require less parking. And people, you know, began to see that this, you know, SEPTA is this incredible resource that we have. And, you know, and our you know, very humanly scaled walkable streets are part of our great inheritance.
So we have
desirable city.
We've only got about the remaining 15, 20 seconds we have. The difference between Philly in the late 90s and Philly in 2020 in terms of how we've evolved.
Oh, this is much more fun. Fun place.
Inga, thank you so much. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but it was great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Thank you so much.
Inga Saffron is the architecture critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer and author of a new book called Becoming Philadelphia, How an Old American City Made Itself New Again. As always, you can find us on social media. Head to whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producer is John Ahrens, with help today from Debbie Builder. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, great to have you with us as well. Take care.